The colored section that follows is that representing the regional education attendance areas, and the colored section that follows that is the list representing the needs of the municipalities.
So, you don't prioritize amongst those three?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you do also?
Yes, sir, we do.
Where is that?
If you'll look on the left-hand side of the white section, there's a number beside each project. That's the priority ranking. Beginning with the REAA projects, under our category one, which is those projects which are designed to abate health and life safety issues, the individual projects are ranked according to the number of students involved in each project. So the number one priority is the Bering Strait Schools district-wide code upgrade, life safety, major maintenance. That's number one simply by virtue of the number of students. And if you look to the right of the description of the project, you'll see the enrollment. And the ranking is a direct function of the enrollment and the type of project. All of the life safety projects are listed in this one group. And then you can see that the third column is a priority type. Then within the number category twos, again, starting with the highest enrollment, projects are ranked.
Okay. But I mean, between the white section, the yellow section, and the blue section, there's not,
you do not have
one overall list. Ranking.
No.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Just a couple of general ones, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Phipps to come to the table, please. You mentioned a supplemental request. We're all anxiously waiting for the foundation funding portion. Do you have approximate number of dollars that will be within that request from the department?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Go ahead.
General fund supplemental request, $5.5 million rounded off for PL 874, $2.3 million rounded off for a total of $7.8 million.
Does the department have anything else in the supplemental besides foundation funding there?
Yes, sir. We have a couple of three minor requests, about $50,000 to make up for a shortfall in interagency receipts at the Stewart Vocational Technical Center, a request for authority to receive and expend teacher certification fees. I believe that's it, Mr. Chairman, in addition to the foundation program.
And the other thing that was stated, Commissioner, some technical changes in the formula funding program. We'll be looking forward to working with you on that and identifying what they are and what has to be done. Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question since you brought something to my mind. PL 874 funds. And they're pass-through. I know they're pass-through directly to the school districts in the rural communities. Are they also pass-through directly to the communities that have primarily military students, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kodiak?
Mr. Chairman, yes and no. Let me see if I can really do this bureaucratically. The majority of the $70 million that comes into the state is a payment directly to the school districts. The department then offsets a portion of that under the foundation program. With respect to these youngsters who live on base in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kodiak, the Department of Education is the applicant for and recipient of those funds. We get about $20 million for the on-base youngsters. That money is credited as a revenue source for the foundation program and then just distributed through the formula. So the Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kodiak municipalities receive foundation support for their military-connected youngsters. They also receive tuition payments in lieu of local taxes for each of those youngsters. There are some portions of the 874 revenues which may not be taken into account in the state program. For instance, money attributable to Indian lands students and money attributable to federally connected special education youngsters. The balance is deducted from foundation payments up to 90%.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, During the interim, I was contacted by parents on Fort Rich. Although it's not part of my district, they do know that I have some history with military bases and military families. They are quite concerned about the facilities on Fort Rich as well as the instruction. And if you haven't heard about it, let me encourage you to see what is going on Fort Rich, because those parents over there are very irate. They're talking about boycotts and many other sorts of things as it relates to their children's educational needs.
Mr. Chairman, if I may briefly respond to Representative Barnes. Trust me, we've heard from them. We're presently negotiating with the feds for federal financial assistance to upgrade those facilities under what's popularly characterized as the Dole Report, which is a nationwide assessment of all military school facilities. In addition, the governor has included in his FY90 capital budget about $1.7 million for dealing with the most egregious life code safety problems in both Fairbanks and Anchorage. We're working on it, unfortunately, in those kinds of facilities issues where there's where the facility is owned by the federal government and given to the state under a use permit and then passed on to a municipality under another use permit. It just takes a long time to figure out who's going to have to ultimately bite the bullet. But we're trying to sort it out.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can recall when those schools were put under this use permit theory, where they're now being passed from one entity to another and the shuffling of responsibilities is taking place. And I find that that is a bit more than I can swallow, because we all know who's ultimately responsible. We are receiving PL 874 funds for those students, and I think it's a disgrace that we allow military children to go to school in schools that are not safe.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions of Mr. Holler, the commissioner? If not, on the education subcommittee this year will be myself, Representative Boyer, Representative McLean, and Representative Sherry Davis. Okay, thank you, gentlemen, very much. Ron. Post-secondary commission. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
All those nice things.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you today. My name is Ron Phipps. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, and also the executive officer of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. It was my understanding that I would have just a few moments today, so I have a very thin handout that you should have before you. I'd like to discuss just a few notions using the handout. The commission was established many years ago. It is essentially a coordinating board, and many states indeed have coordinating boards. The major objective of the commission was to be a nonpartisan objective viewpoint related to higher education, and indeed that was this part of our function. On the first page in the handout, you see the makeup of the commission. There has been a change. The legislative representative now in the Senate, it is Senator Paul Fisher. And however, in the House, it is we maintain Representative Neela Kopanen. As you notice, there are several duties and functions of the commission, and most of them now are operational. And I perhaps be a good idea at this time to respond to Representative Brown's comment about the last three activities on that page, namely reviewing the annual budgets of the colleges and universities, planning and coordinating the development of post-secondary education growth, and advising to the functions. Although they are still in statute, we don't do them anymore. A couple years ago, the staff for those functions was eliminated from the budget. So they are still in statute, but we just have not had the opportunity to do that. We do, however, authorize the activities 1 through 11, And many of those are interrelated. For instance, we authorize all post-secondary education institutions to operate. We, of course, administer the student loan program, SEIG, WICHE, and all of these are interrelated in that students who take loans out, we either could have a SEIG grant, could indeed have a WICHE grant, or indeed have the student have a student loan. We conduct an annual survey of Alaska high school seniors. We've done that for several years, and we also produce an annual directory. I think we missed last year because of staffing problems. We hope to have a directory this year. So basically, we're now operational, The thing that drives our commission, of course, is the Alaska Student Loan Program. Last year, of course, the Alaska Student Loan Corporation was established, and the major function of the corporation is to finance student loans. Last year, as a matter of fact, they issued bonds for about $84 million to indeed finance the loans for last year. And we will issue bonds again this year. This has made a profound effect upon the operations of our commission because now our constituents are not only the folks here in Alaska, but also the bondholders, the people who expect us to pay back the bonds, and I will get into that in a few minutes. But very briefly, if you turn to the next page, I'd like to give you some update of what's happening to the student loan program. I have information up to 1987-88, and as you notice there, the loan volume has been dropping, and it has dropped again this year. As of last Friday or so, the dollar amount of student loans for this current year is now around $63, $64 million. The number of loan awards has dropped considerably to around 14,000. However, the average loan has gone up, which we expected because of higher tuition costs throughout the country. But indeed, the loan volume has dropped off. We expect it to level off and perhaps increase next year. We tried to understand why there has been a drop, and so we did several studies to try to attempt to see if there were certain people that we were disenfranchising. For instance, we looked to see were there less females borrowing money, or people who are over 25, or under 25, or in rural areas, or in urban areas. We found that's not the case at all. There seems to be a drop throughout Alaska. So our conclusion was that there are essentially three reasons for the drop, we think. Number one, we've had an awful lot of people leave the state. And unfortunately, I think that has also affected our default rate adversely. I think the 8% now, it was 5%, and now that we have 8%, that certainly has an effect. And also, we do not have forgiveness for the loans. So I think those three factors have contributed a great deal to the declining loan volume. The next page and the last page, and this is a very uncomfortable comment because I'm well aware of the very unpopular notion about adding staff, and yet we are going to ask for a considerable number of staff. That's the bad news. The good news, however, is that all the staff that we were asking for will be funded out of program receipts, the corporation receipts, and it is our expectation, a very strong expectation, that all of these people, by the way, will be in repayments. And by doing so, we will not only pay for the folks, but we will increase the net revenue to the state because of the amount of money that these folks will be able to collect. But it has a lot of other effects also. Again, as I mentioned before, the issuing of bonds has had an effect upon our agency in that the bondholders expect us to collect these loans. Over the years, of course, our staff has not increased at all. It did increase last year by 6 in repayment staff, but for 4 or 5 years prior to that, it remained constant around 15 people. Yet our accounts have risen incredibly, and they're still rising, even if we stop the loan program today. we would have repayments coming into an accelerating rate of repayments coming in for the foreseeable future. We have not increased staff, and we are now way, way, way behind. And quite frankly, we are to the point where the staff has very low morale. We are behind in correspondence for about 3 or 4 months. Many people are now going into delinquency because we are not able to maintain contact. And I think that's probably the most important issue here, is that by us not being able to maintain contact, we are losing folks who will eventually go into default, and of course we lose the money to the state. So a large portion of the staff that we're asking for, in fact almost all, will go into repayment, and we anticipate that with only a small amount of effort, we'll be able to recover the dollars paying for the staff and indeed have a net increase. But it also increases the value of our bonds. As we reduce our default rate, our bonds have better value. As we lower them, and we also lower the amount of debt service. So it has so many interrelated positive effects that we would certainly urge you to think of consider the increase in repayment very favorably. Another major issue is our data processing system. It was established in 1979, and it was primarily developed to award loans. So these were the days when, of course, oil was pouring in, and at that time the state didn't really care about collecting loans. We have changed the software over and over and over again to the point where it is clearly inadequate, especially inadequate because, again, the rating agencies and the folks who hold our bonds, in that we are not able to provide data for these people that they require. We are, in fact, one important issue is trying to determine the fund source. Before, we didn't care, of course. Now we have to know where these funds come from, whether they come from the bonds, whether they come from pledge receipts, whether they come from elsewhere. These are two major problems that we have, and we ask you to think about, consider them in a positive fashion. I'll be pleased to answer any questions.
Anyone? Representative Rieger.
Just a couple of points. Mr. Chairman, I hope that there's more, I guess, more comments than questions, but I'll be real brief. If you have rewritten the software 8 years in a row on the data processing service, I'm not sure that I'd be ready to sign off on rewriting it a ninth time. I don't know what the, I guess you're talking about a total new system. But, you know, we've had, not in your department, but statewide, a pretty shaky track record on new systems, new computer systems. They generally cost a fortune and they don't work the way you wanted them to. And so I guess without, I know it's unfair for you because you guys haven't done this, but I'm skeptical at the outset of a new software system given the state's track record. The other is on the collection of loans. I really have a preference to go to private collection agencies. And one of the questions I think we should have to be asking ourselves in every aspect of the budget is, can the private sector do it? And I'd rather have the private sector do it, even if it's a coin toss. And so I hope that the subcommittee will really scrutinize that, and in a coin toss situation or anything close, go to the private sector for the collection of these loans.
Chair, please.
Thank you. If I may, I'd like to address both of them. We are asking for a complete new data processing system. We have issued the RFP. The corporation provided considerable dollars in this current year, so we are in the process now we've had a consultant that wrote the RFP. We're now in the process of soliciting contractors to write the software. We think what will happen is there are many GSL packages out there, and although we're not the Stafford loan, the guaranteed student loan, although we are not like the guaranteed student loan, I think that our system can be modified relatively simply using a package, and there's several out there. Your second comment, we welcome that evaluation. About 3 or 4 years ago, I think that was explored, and at that time, we found that it was cheaper to do it in house. However, things have changed, and there is considerable accounts in repayment now.
Any other questions? If not, we look forward to working with you very closely, and maybe sometime in the near future we can just sit down and have a little discussion on, you know, how we can facilitate and help each other.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Meeting's adjourned. Hi, Mary.
Okay,
at this time we're going to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and therefore we're able to conduct business. The first item on the agenda today is House Bill 100. That's an act making appropriations for the operating capital and loans program expenses of the state government and providing for an effective date. The purpose of the meeting on House Bill 100 today is to start our official action then in relation to House Bill 100. And the first thing would be officially assigning the subcommittee chairmen and members. So what Representative Hoffman and I then have done is prepared a list and had it put on the table of each member. Now that list is about 95% complete. It is not totally complete yet. There are a few vacancies that have to be filled. There's a change or two that's yet to take place, and some minority members are yet to be assigned responsibilities on subcommittees, but it's about 95% complete there. Does anyone have any questions in relation to the subcommittee list? No. Yes, Representative Rieger?
Maybe not on the list, but just a question. Will House Bill 100 be before the committee again, before it actually formally goes to the subcommittees after today?
Well, I was going to formally kind of send it to subcommittees today. Is there some general discussion that you would like to bring up and discuss on it first? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think it would be a more productive use of the subcommittee's time if the Finance Committee adopted a working draft number for House Bill 100, which was different than the governor's number.
Okay, what I would like to do is have you reserve that comment until I kind of get through the list here.
Okay.
And then if I haven't covered some area, then we'll discuss it at that time.
Okay.
So we have the subcommittee chairmen, then in members. I'd like the subcommittee chairmen, of course, to officially contact the members that are assigned to their committee. I think most of them know that they're tentatively on the committee, but this will officially then start to place them on that committee. A thing that's always hard is, of course, to find time and space for the subcommittees to meet, to hold their various hearings on their agencies of the budget. We can coordinate this office here through Joyce Nelson. However, there are heavy demands upon this room here. So if the subcommittee chairmen know of any other alternative sites or areas that they could use, we'd encourage you to try to schedule those areas, too, as early as possible. But Representative Hoffman's office and our office will be able to assist you, too, in trying to find additional areas if this room here is taken up at the time in which you wish. But we would ask the subcommittee chairmen to please put in writing their request as soon as they know of dates and time in which they would like to hold subcommittee meetings so that we can help you in your scheduling. We'd also ask the subcommittee chairmen to make contact with the commissioners of the various agencies, also the fiscal analysts and members of OMB that have been assigned to the various agencies. If you don't know exactly who those are, and I'm sure you're kind of like me, I don't know who all of them are, we'll have to look back in that little handout we gave you at the first day. The fiscal analysts and OMB members are listed there. But one other thing that Representative Hoffman brought up that I think is a very good idea and that we want to follow through, that as we look at the budget in relation to our various agencies, that we also take a look at the budget this year concentrating on one area. And that doesn't mean that all areas aren't important, but we're going to look at the concentration of the criminal justice area. And we're going to ask Representative Swackhammer to chair a small committee. Besides being the chairman of the subcommittees on law, public safety, and corrections, we want him to chair the small committee and work with Representative Ulmer, who has the subcommittee on courts and also administration, especially with the public defenders portion of it, and to also add to that small group Representative Gruenberg. So Representative Swackhammer, Ulmer, and Gruenberg then, besides working on their individual agency areas, will also work on a program area to see if we can provide some coordination between all of those various agencies, which can constitute, of course, a reduced budget and at the same time increased efficiency by having all those five agencies connected with criminal justice more closely coordinated. So if that's possible, we're going to ask you folks to take a look at that. Another thing that subcommittee chairmen are always interested in is caps. And I wish, Representative Rieger, we had those numbers yet. As you know, our fiscal policy committee, which you're a member of, is working along that line. And then Representative Hoffman and I are also working with the summit, Governor's Summit. And hopefully soon we'll be able to coordinate all of our thoughts so that we can come up with some numbers, not only on what we're going to look at for revenues, but also what we're going to look at for reduction levels within the operating budget as originally proposed. As soon as we can come to some coordination then with the fiscal policy group, agreeing as those numbers are solid so that we can agree with the summit folks that those numbers are solid, then we can start coming up with caps that which we'll have each agency then try to work within. So do you have any more in what you would like to add in relation to caps then at this time?
Mr. Chair, I guess this can be subject to further discussion. I think it might be preferable maybe to have House Bill 100 back before us the day that we talk about the caps. That's okay. My only point, because I think a motion that day might be in order.
Sure, I would see no problem with that. Any discussion on that point? Hearing none then, when we are ready to the point to talk about caps, we will have a hearing once again before the full committee on House Bill 100.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Brown.
What is your intention with respect to the capital budget section of this budget? Is that being referred to subcommittee at this time, or how's that going to be handled?
Yes, the capital budget in the reappropriation budget is being handled by Representative Hoffman. In the loans portion of the budget will be handled through Representative Swackhammer.
So is that going to be a formal subcommittee, or is that being determined?
Let me ask Representative Hoffman if he's thought this through yet.
Well, I really haven't given it that much thought at this time. The governor, I went through the capital budget, but I guess we could discuss other options at this time. I wasn't considering a subcommittee. I don't think that there was a subcommittee in prior years. But if other members have some ideas on how to approach the capital budget, maybe they could come and talk to me at their convenience.
Okay, the only other comment I had then before we officially sign House Bill 100 to the various subcommittees is that Representative Hoffman's office and my office and our staff stand ready to help and assist in whichever way possible we can the various subcommittees. And from time to time, we will probably be sending to the chairman some recommendations. So any other discussion then on House Bill 100? Hearing none, then, unless there's objections, we will send House Bill 100, with the exception that when we talk about caps, we'll bring it back up to the various subcommittee chairmen. Are there any objections? Hearing none, then, so ordered. Okay, the next item on the agenda today is the budget overviews, and we have the Department of Administration and the Department of Corrections. First would be the Department of Administration, and chairing the Department of Administration will be Representative Ulmer, and serving with her on the subcommittee will be Representatives Boucher, Brown, and Phillips. So at this time, I'd like to recognize Commissioner Andrews.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I believe you have two handouts that we prepared for today's presentation. One is a larger volume that describes in some detail, division by division, the functions and organization and statutory authority of the division, with some summary information that provides an overview of the budget. For ease of presentation today, I would invite your attention to the smaller document that is a 7-page summary of information in a larger document. The first two pages of this summary were an effort to make clear to those of you who may not be as familiar as others with how what the department does and how it's organized and what the problems are we're struggling with and what we consider some of our points of progress we've made along the way. First page indicates the 16 divisions that compose the department and their directors' names. The vertical columns are an effort to try to share with you my perception of the multiplicity of kinds of things the department does. We have grown over the last 10 years from a department with 7 divisions, most of which were the mainline administrative functions you would expect a department with that name to carry out. The only strange bedfellow at that point was the Division of Pioneer Benefits that has been there for some time. During those 10 years, we've grown from 7 divisions to 16, and most of those additions have been divisions that function not to serve other state agencies, but to provide services to the public. And those have accumulated from the Department of Law, from the Governor's Office, from the court system, here and there, education. The second page is a representation of what we consider the problems of the moment are in those various divisions, with some indication in the rightmost column of progress we've made in addressing those objectives. They range, as do the points of service of the various divisions. The problems we deal with range all over the map. One of our difficulties in managing a department with so many miscellaneous kinds of functions going on is it's very difficult in the commissioner's office to retain on the central management staff the expertise you need to manage all those disparate functions. We cannot afford to have a lawyer and a doctor and a CPA and a property control person and all that in the commissioner's office. So we have counted on developing our general management expertise in my office and counting on the divisions for technical expertise in their various areas. And I think we've been pretty successful, particularly with the latter part of that, in that many of our division directors have extensive credentials in their field of expertise, and that has accounted in no small measure for the success we've made in improving the operation of the department. The third page is a capsule view of the budget as it relates to those distinctions between service to other state agencies and services to the public. You can see there that more than two-thirds of the general fund money in the current budget goes for services to the public. Less than 30% constitutes general funding for services to other state agencies. Page four is a little different way to look at the general fund budget for the department, in that what I meant to convey by this is the portion of the budget that is subject to relative degrees of flexibility. Given the current statutes, the longevity bonus, the 35% of the general fund budget that is the longevity bonus grant payments, is fixed. We pay everybody who qualifies legally and pay them in the dollar amount specified in the statute. Moving around clockwise, the piece of the pie there that is the 16% for leasing is not as fixed as longevity bonus, but given the size of the various departments and their office space needs the limited control we have over pricing in the market and the long-term leases we have inherited and whatnot, that $25 million is fairly inflexible. The other 48% of the general fund budget is the lowest degree of inflexibility, still subject to the requirement that we carry out our statutory mandate. But there really is only half of the budget that we can really do much about at all, even in our doomsday scenario kind of deal. Page,
Commissioner, can I interrupt you for just one second? Out of curiosity here, that EPORS has always intrigued me just as to what the $803,000 was for. Is that surely can't be the contributions of existing active members who are, say, still in the legislature? That 803, is that some matching fund to a retirement program, or
EPORS? As correct me if I'm wrong, okay, but my understanding of that is that the general fund cost of those additional public officers who would retire next year that's needed to pay their retirement benefits.
Okay. Yes, Representative Phillips?
It's not on EPORS, but it's on the your leasing policy, this $25 million. Where is most of your office space leased out to? What part of the state? Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau?
In Anchorage, I would guess, surely. May I invite
Deputy
Commissioner Taylor?
Here, maybe we could get a chair there. Thank you.
Most of the office space is located in Anchorage and Juneau.
Okay, and when are some of these leases going to expire, particularly in the Anchorage area?
I think we rent 35 or more facilities in Anchorage. A lot of them expire over various times. Two of them are coming up in the next fiscal year, attempting to vacate part of the Frontier Building.
Mm-hmm.
And have I answered your question?
Yeah.
Representative Phillips would be able to call your office to get
more
details.
Yeah, I will later on. I'm just letting them know what some of my interests.
Sure.
Excuse the interruption, Commissioner, would you proceed.
Sure. The last three pages are a very brief summary of the first, the supplemental requests that we have before the body on for the current fiscal year, a summary of the FY90 increments and decrements, and finally on page 7, the three capital items in our budget request. It's interesting to me to note on page 5, if you will, that the for the current year's operations, the supplemental requests we felt like we had to put forward fall almost entirely in the services to the public portion of the budget. The 97.6 thousand that I would classify as services to state agencies, both those items result in the labor turmoil that we've been involved in over recent months, well, going on 2 years now. The 70,000 in the Labor Relations Agency for the costs of that agency holding hearings on this and that with respect to labor relations questions. 7.6 in personnel is a similar item for the personnel board to review grievances in the absence of a contract with the general government unit employees. In the services to the public side of the supplementals, far and away the bulk of that dollar amount is the $1.4 million for longevity bonus payments. You will recall at the end of the last session, we reduced our budget request by, as I recall, about $900,000. That turned out to be more wishful thinking than an accurate prediction. As it turns out, we need that back in another $2 million more in order to carry out that program through the end of the year. The two items in the middle for public defender and OPA are in response to the increasing caseload, primarily for child in need of aid cases, and the early start of the 63,004 House Bill 7, you recall from last year, House Bill 7 passed the legislature, but the fiscal note attached to it got lost in the shuffle somehow. We felt that the purposes embodied in that bill were important enough to go ahead and begin during the current fiscal year rather than wait for funding in the ensuing year, so we have asked for money to do that. The bottom number of 18,000 is miscellaneous claims, which is a list of small claims submitted to the state for payment for prior year's obligations that weren't paid for some reason. On page 6, the general fund increments for the coming fiscal year, again, the bulk of the dollar amount is in pioneer benefits for longevity bonus payments. Associated with that is $46,000 for the increase in postage costs. When postage went up to 25 cents, that hit those guys pretty hard. Again, in the middle, the public defender and OPA, carrying forward the supplemental request for this year into the following year, plus adding the Westlaw computer system for the public defender. And or say about that, if there's any questions, I'm happy to see that it will get some special attention, the coordination of those functions with other court services functions and whatnot, I think could stand some review. The other big item on that page is the $874,000 for lease space cost. That number was the current year's general fund appropriation minus the amount of money we expect to collect from other departments for which they are providing funding. And the difference in that is the $874,000 that would be short. In the capital side, we have three items before you. $1.4 million for the second phase of the new payroll system, which was funded in about that amount last year. As to status on that, a contract has been signed with Pricewaterhouse, I think it is. and work has begun even this month to build that. We remain confident that the $3 million total for that project, of which this is phase two, will in fact be sufficient to bring that system online and on time. The $5.5 million for computer upgrades is an unavoidable cost from our point of view, in that we have put off expanding the mainframe capacity for as long as I think we can afford to gamble. And this is the cost of bringing it up to a capacity that will last for several years. That they're really the only variable we have to work with in that is whether or not we pay for it all at once or whether we spread those payments out over time, which is a real variable, but the cost comes out the same in the end. It costs a lot of money. The $500,000 for capital projects in the Pioneer Benefits Division is for a list of repairs that need to be done to the various Pioneers' homes. There is always a list. They're always there, but they're serious nonetheless. It is asbestos removal and handicap access and functions like that. Well, that's a very quick overview. Is any area you'd like to go into?
Are there any questions by any members of the committee? Representative Barnes?
Thank you. Under Pioneer Benefits, you show 1,410 longevity bonus recipients. Is that correct? Is that service to the public under Pioneer Benefits on page 5?
The $1,410,000, that is the increase in bonus payments.
Oh, I see.
But more and more people qualifying for the program.
Could you give us a number of the people that are now qualified for the program?
It's approximately 18,000 receiving payments. Slightly higher than that are qualified, but for there's always a few percent that are out of state for a minute and don't get a check in any 1 month. About 18,000 checks are written.
Commissioner, would you have any statistics as to within that 18,000, the number of those who have been added within the last year and those who have been added within the last year, say, who are residents of Alaska for two or fewer years? Do you have any information like that?
I'm sure we do on the first part. Jim, can you help me?
Yes.
Jim Fox.
Please identify yourself for the record. And
Jim Fox. We currently are running about
20% of all new ones coming in are less than 2 year residents. More than one.
Yeah. More than one.
Yeah. Representative Phillips.
This is something that's been sticking in my craw for at least the last 2 or 3 years. And I know I've asked, and this would be the third year in a row asking for this, trying to get this information, but I do know that you don't have to be a citizen of the United States to qualify for this program. I've asked the division to put that on the application. Are you a citizen of the United States or not? And that, to my knowledge, has not been done yet. But do you guys have any idea how many people who are not United States citizens who are recipients of this program?
On the same line of questioning, are we sending the longevity bonus to anyone who's incarcerated?
Is that not on the application? Is that?
Yes. I do not know.
But we don't have anyone who's 65 or older that's incarcerated. There is. Okay. Thank you. Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions on a few points you went over. On the computer, the new computer system, I know this all didn't happen on your watch, Commissioners, but I'm just curious, do you know roughly how much money the state's spent on Department of Administration computer systems since 1980?
Yes, sir, I do.
Round numbers, how many tens of millions?
It's a staggering round number. I'm not sure that 1980 is exactly where my number came from, but it's in that neighborhood. Within a year or two, we spent, we spent on the average of $5 million a year, which to me is staggering. And I in that frame of mind, I beat up on people as much as I thought I could get away with to try to cut that number down, at least lop a million off of that or cut in half or something to try to figure out how to bring it under control. For a state of our size and population, it's staggering, but we're an unusual body in our population. The geographic spread in the state is one of the things that contributes to the cost. You have to have every state office all hooked up to the same thing when you're spread all over a subcontinent makes it an expensive operation. At one point, I told one of our the salesmen of our largest vendor, an unnamed vendor, that if I was successful in my tenure here, I would never spend a penny in their shop. Well, it didn't work out that great. Looks like we're going to have to spend some there, but at least we put it off for a year or two. Maybe we can lower that average some. It's a very expensive business. We have one of the most sophisticated computer operations in the country.
It sure is a frustrating thing. It seemed in my head it must have been around 40 or 50 million we spent this decade on computers.
That's the neighborhood, right? On the other hand, if I might, in defense of, we're not totally foolish about this, we're not just buying toys for ourselves. When you look at all of the things that computer operation does for all of the agencies, you get a little less hostile about it. If you want the policeman on the road to be able to call in a license number and find a warrant in any state in the nation, and on, if you want the clerk in the welfare office to be able to get the payments out to people in a timely manner so they don't sue them. If you want all that to work, again and again, those people count on that computer, and it's the pain in that now that brings this proposal before us, that it isn't working well enough to keep all those people functioning in their responsibilities. So it's not wasted money. It's just a very expensive way to do business. But it works.
Please proceed.
Just a couple other questions on each one on a different subject. But on the telecommunications operation that the department runs, are you in a position in what you do to receive some of these equalizing monies that are part of that pool that AT&T set up nationwide? I mean, are you getting some money from this nationwide equalizing pool?
No, sir, we are not getting any money from that, nor would we ever be apt to. That is a at least partially regulated activity amongst regulated carriers, which we are not. We are a customer of the regulated carriers, so we don't share in that more than the banks do or the oil companies or their other large customers.
I was just curious. I heard someone complaining about it, but I didn't know enough about the issue to know to really ask the right question. But they were saying that maybe that was the case. But I'm glad to hear it's not. The last question I have is, could you give us a little status report on where are the? You mentioned in your presentation the labor negotiations, and I know I heard the governor on statewide TV the other day say that you couldn't do anything because the courts had told you couldn't do anything. I was wondering, could you elaborate on that? What have the courts told the state to do or not to do?
By way of introduction to that, I understand there is scheduled next week before the budget summit group an extensive briefing on that. Session dedicated to that, as I understand it. But I can tell you fairly concisely, I think, a little over a year ago, in September or October of 1987, after extensive efforts to try to come to some agreement with the general government and labor, trades, and crafts bargaining representatives, we endeavored to impose the proposal we had last at the table as an imposition of terms. That resulted in a court action on the part of both those bargaining representatives. As it turned out, first time anybody'd ever done this in state government, we didn't do it as perfectly as we should have. There was enough stumbling there on our part for them to find some legal recourse against us, and all that ended up in court. The Superior Court, I guess it is, supported us largely in that we did have the authority to do what we did. That was appealed to the Supreme Court and has yet to be heard there. It's not, I'm not sure when the Supreme Court will rule on that, but it probably won't be before this summer, and there's no guarantee that it'll be this year even, although I think it will be. One event that's significant in that is that as those court cases were happening that October a year ago, we signed a stipulation that we would not change the terms and conditions of employment for people in those bargaining units until one of three things happened. Either the Supreme Court ruled on the case finally, or the legislature changed the law that made it clear, or we came to some agreement with the people in those bargaining units. And none of those three things have happened yet. So I have a very well-worn copy of that stipulation on my desk. I keep looking for something there that will let me get off the dime, and boy, they just didn't there. We got to wait for the courts or your body to make the court action no longer necessary.
So,
or come to some agreement. There seems to be no incentive on the other side of the bargain table to come to an agreement, because otherwise they're guaranteed the status quo. So,
So the state won the court suit, but the state also signed away whatever it would have gained out of winning that court suit. In a nutshell.
Boiled way down, yeah. We didn't win all of the court suit. There was some question of whether a restraining order would be in place or whatnot.
Could you tell me, just why did you sign such a stipulation?
I don't mean to be facetious, but the thing that comes to my mind is it seemed like a good idea at the time. I wish we hadn't, in a way, but there we are. So, on the advice of counsel and after a lot of careful thought, hindsight's always easier, but it seemed like the prudent move at the time.
So really, but I mean, just to make it clear, when the administration blames the courts for the lack of their ability to do something, it was really should blame themselves.
Oh, I didn't mean to blame the courts.
Oh, no, and you didn't, but I mean, I heard that on TV the other night. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions of the commissioner? Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. One involves your capital request for $5.5 million to expand the mainframe system. I was wondering what kind of economic analysis you've done of looking at other alternatives, such as a more decentralized system of microcomputers or mini-computers that might be able to serve that need for computing power at a cheaper cost. Have you costed that out and looked at those other types of alternatives to an expansion of the mainframe?
Not in any grand consultant's analytical report sense, no, we have not. But we do, project by project, do that kind of analysis. And there have been some things that have moved off the mainframe, and that's partly been what's contributed to the extension of its life from this year's budget to next year's budget. I'm not sure where to start. Some things just cannot be decentralized. The biggest customer of the mainframe is our own accounting system, Access, AKSAS. And they are 50% of the operation of the mainframe in Juneau. Likewise, in the data center in Anchorage, health and social services operations and the public safety operations are something like 80% of the drain on that machine. So there is a piece of the pie there that you can entertain alternate ways of delivering the computing power, and we do that, but we have not even seriously tried to think of not having a
centralized mainframe data center.
I'd be interested in exploring that issue more with you in the subcommittee. My other question relates to the status of our health benefits, and I'm really not sure how that fits in with your department, although I have the impression that you are in charge of the health benefit area. And I thought that there was going to be a large supplemental asking for more money for that. Could you fill us in on the status of that whole situation?
Sure. Chuck knows more about this than anybody.
The administration will be asking for approximately $18 million supplemental. The administration will be signing contracts with Aetna effective the 1st of February for another 12 months, providing the same coverage as we do today. It will be a 5% increase, and I believe the total will be up to about, on the average, $435 per employee per month. During the course of the summer, the executive branch, representatives of legislative affairs and the court system met on the issue. And basically, first, the things that we can do without going through collective bargaining are to look at and manage our health insurance data better so we know what's going on. This is the first time this year that the state of Alaska has looked at its own data. It's been pretty much ignored in previous years. Also, the Division of Retirement Benefits will be gearing up what I call a communication and education program for state employees concerning health awareness, fitness, wellness programs, et cetera. That will take a while to implement, realizing we can't get a chunk of money to start a full-blown program right away. In terms of changing the health insurance benefits, I believe basically all the other bargaining units that we've settled with have agreed to whatever GGU will come up with. And in order to change deductibles, coinsurance, or level of benefits, we have to get agreement at the bargaining table.
Could I just follow that up, Mr. Chairman? So even though you've outlined here what your supplemental is, it does not...
Office of Management Budget be requesting that supplemental, since it affects all state agencies. We don't have in our budget the $60 million that we pay to Aetna. We collect it from the various...
I see.
It's on somebody's list.
Okay.
I just noticed that $435 per month times 12 months, that's $5,220 per year. That's almost as much as it costs to be in the hospital for a couple of days. Representative Rieger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this contract that you're going to sign on February 1st, are there any provisions for breaking that contract?
Yes, there are provisions that if we reach agreement and decide to change the plan, price reductions, et cetera, will go into effect.
Are those negotiated now? I mean, do you have a kind of a schedule as part of this contract you're entering into as to what the rate would be with different deductibles and different rates?
We have that information.
That is not part of the contract.
Not part of the contract.
We have estimates that the actuaries put together that if you changed it in this way, chances are it'd go down about 20.5%.
The numbers, you feel comfortable you can count on those numbers happening if, in fact...
Highly confident.
Highly confident. Okay, thank you.
Representative Copen and then Representative Phillips.
On the same matter, have you looked into either finding another provider or the state's becoming a self-insurer like the university system?
I believe he's Vice President Blue Cross stopped by my office before lunch hour, and I asked him the same question. If we were to go out to bid, would he be interested? His answer was a definite no. Most insurance carriers don't want to insure anymore. What they want to do is be the third-party administrator processing claims. They can make money doing that. Blue Cross of Washington, Alaska lost $43 million last year on the state of Washington's. They don't want to be in that business. And there are, to best of my knowledge, maybe one or two other insurers who may or may not be interested. Most of them don't want to touch it. Self-insurance, you can obtain a one-time cash flow savings. Given the makeup of the plan currently and without some sort of cost containment, I wouldn't want to do it. And also, we would properly do it, we would need about an 18.
I'd add to that. From my perspective, the problem is the same on both scenarios, another provider or insured ourselves. Neither Aetna nor the Department of Administration wants to insure an uninsurable plan. And that was the way it was put to me at one point by representatives of the insurance industry, that our plan is lacks sufficient discipline to make it a good insurance risk. I mean, it has no controls in it to provide incentives to control costs and whatnot. It invites very little financial participation on the part of the participant in the plan at that next doctor's visit, at that point of deciding as to whether or not there's no incentive for the participant to control the cost. Because the co-insurance and the deductible on that is paid up very early in the year. The rest of it's free after that. That makes it not a very attractive insurance risk. So if we can, through collective bargaining, get an insurable plan formulated that still adequately serves the needs of the employees, then I think we'll have some competition for coverage and would be seriously interested in maybe insuring it ourselves. But until it's insurable, in that sense, it's sort of a subjective definition.
Okay, Representative Phillips?
Ron, I just want to make this aware to the members of the committee. I know that one copy was sent to the President of the Senate and one to the Speaker of the House, and I had to specifically request this copy. But I'd recommend that each member of the Finance to get a copy of this document, see how health benefits. And they do make recommendations. Here, changes, give me about 10 seconds, 15 seconds, it's changes to the health plan design, the estimate cost, and we can go right down the line and look at them and see where we can save some money here. That, by the way, was part of the letter of intent in the budget document last year to have this report ready for the legislature this year. I'd highly recommend all of us to read that, and we might save some money this way.
Okay, any other questions of Commissioner Andrews? Representative Copeland.
Yes, I'm looking at some of the odder little programs you have in there, public advocacy, public defender, and the like. Wondering about the guardian ad litem program. I've seen some problems with it in selection of attorneys who have familiarity with children's problems, and also the difficulty given the fact that the courts make assignments of guardia ad litem all over the place. Attorneys don't live all over the place. What about such things? And on the one hand, a selection of people who not only are legally competent, but also competent to deal with problems affecting children and their families. You know, what sort of standards do you apply? And the other is, how do you deal with the problem of the costs associated with somebody being in Anchorage or Bethel being assigned a guardian ad litem for a child in Agagic, for example?
Guardian ad litems go through a screening process first, and I believe they get a 2-week training program. We have both paid guardian ad litems. Volunteer programs growing in Anchorage, and this past summer, the Office of Public Advocacy is providing some standards and protocols and, on guardian ad litem. I can't answer your last specific question on a guardian ad litem being assigned in Bethel when the person lives in the house.
Is there any possible administrative saving or, for that matter, just greater efficiency by either combining some of these divisions or moving the responsibility to another department. I notice that administration tends to be the great poobah, and you get stuck with something that all kinds of things that might more properly be put in other departments.
My first draft of this page had the Department of Miscellaneous at the top.
That's why I mentioned Kubat. He was more high at everything else in the Mikado.
In the early days of this administration, there was a fairly concerted effort to try to identify programs that could be better realigned amongst departments, and quite a bit of work went into that. We looked real hard at both the legal part of the department and the senior services part of the department, wondering why they were there in the first place. And we as other departments, were very interested in getting rid of things that didn't fit, but nobody was interested in taking them. And that, to my knowledge, nothing ever moved. I don't know, maybe some little thing did, but nothing out of the Department of Administration. And I've come to understand more how that has come to be and why it's so sticky, why it sticks in place so well. I'm not necessarily condoning all this rationale, but there are several reasons why things end up in the department. Sometimes they're to avoid a stigma that might be attached with another department, meaningful or not. Sometimes it's to avoid apparent conflict of interest. And legal side, we see that. My suspicion, if you will, is that mostly it's to solve somebody's pain in the neck problem rather than the reason they're saying out loud. But nonetheless, here they are. I decided long since to just quit kicking that cactus and get on with trying to figure out how to manage a disparate organization and do that effectively. Keeping the quality of the services we deliver as high as we can and get on with it. So,
okay, we're going to get on with it too. We're going to have to move on here. We thank you, Commissioner, very much. Once again, Representative Ulmer will be chairing the Subcommittee on Administration.
All right.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you, sir.
And we have the Department of Corrections with Commissioner Susan Humphrey Barnett. Commission, welcome to House Finance.
Twilight Zone. Behind this door. It's a fourth dimension.
Maybe we could stand at ease for just a minute here. Well,
a real sense of humor around here.
Pardon?
There's a sense of humor around here. We should say, welcome to the Twilight Zone. You know?
Thank you.
You ready? Okay. Chairman Larson and Chairman Hoffman and committee members, you should have a very brief handout that we passed around. I think perhaps luckily for me, in contrast to the department you just heard from, corrections is largely a one-function agency. We don't have multiple functions. Our function is to supervise offenders, both within the correctional centers and also in the community on probation and parole. I think that makes the focus a little easier to manage. As you're all aware, Alaska's Constitution does have a mandate for corrections. It reads that penal administration shall be based on the principle of reformation and on the need for protecting the public, and numerous statutes have grown out of that constitutional mandate that govern various parts of the Department of Corrections. The duties, again, I think you're all fairly conversant in these, to enforce pretrial supervision and detention, administer sanctions and punishments imposed by the courts for unlawful behavior, offer a wide range of correctional options to include community placement, and provide work and educational and rehabilitative programs for offenders. We currently have 1,269 full-time positions within the department. The last page of your handout shows a map of where our 12 correctional centers and our probation offices are located. The second to the last page gives you an organizational chart. Corrections budget is essentially driven by the increases in the inmate and probation population. Primarily, the most dramatic increases have been in the inmate population over the last 10 years. I've got a brief table in there starting with FY85 that shows you the number of inmates in each fiscal year, the number of employees, and the way that the operating budget has grown. In the early part of this decade, we were growing at the rate of 300 inmates per year, which meant you needed a 300-bed institution to come online every year. In the middle part of the decade, I think in calendar year 86, primarily because of the changes that were made in the Good Time Law, that increase was halved to about 150. And in the last 2 years, we've stayed steady with a 72 inmate increase per year. So right now we're looking at the need to add 150 beds every other year to the system as it currently is growing. In our adjusted base for this year, the only changes of any magnitude in that had to do with full funding positions that we received partial funding for last year. The bulk of that was for the Spring Creek Correctional Center, which was opened at the very end of our last fiscal year. The only program that we've deleted or reduced basically was a grant from the National Institute of Corrections, which expired. We had essentially five themes in our budget this year as we built the budget. They were, the first one was to reduce salary underfunding. The second one was to increase the number of probation officers that we have doing field supervision, because the caseloads for many of our probation officers are upwards of 90 cases per officer, which is a totally unreasonable caseload to manage efficiently or effectively. The third theme was to improve some of the inmate programs. The fourth theme was to provide some essential equipment needs. And the last one was to provide support staff in the institutions. Historically, corrections has only been able to acquire correctional officer positions. So in many institutions, we have correctional officers performing administrative duties, supply and bookkeeping and those kinds of things. And we felt that if we had the addition of some support staff. We didn't. As it turned out, I pretty much gave you those budget themes in priority order, and there are no very few support staff included in our increments. Just a quick rundown of the areas where we did ask for increments. We asked for probation officers in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Dillingham. We also asked for program services aides in rural Alaska. One of the things that I'm very proud of that we've done in the last year is put a very strong emphasis on native hire, and we've done very well in native hire in the correctional officer series. We've done less well in native hire in the probation officer series. Part of the reason is that we have a standard that probation officers must have a college degree. Other states pretty much have that same standard. We found that in rural Alaska, that's been a barrier to employment. So we've asked for program services aides, which will experience as a program services aide in a probation office will count the same as a college degree after they've had, I'm not sure if it's going to be 2 years experience, I think, or 4 years, but that will be a way to have an entry-level position for Native Alaskans into the probation field, which is something we've been criticized about for. I've got a couple of positions for the Cook Inlet pretrial facility. I would guess in a given year that we have more mentally ill offenders going through Cook Inlet than API has. We have a lot of people there that whose mental health needs are very severe, and we're not keeping up with it very well. The only equipment we ended up asking for are replacement handheld radios. Handheld radios are the only means of communication that officers on the floor have with other officers. It's a real safety factor if they're working with radios that don't work. We have a number of increments that are related to program issues. Inmate gate money is one. Money for post-secondary and vocational education programs. Money for a community residential center for mentally ill and developmentally disabled offenders. I think this one's really critical, and it ties in with an increment that is in the health and social services budget. They've asked for half of the money, and we've asked for half. As it stands right now, there are offenders who get released from correctional centers that are not safe to be in the community, but they've served their time, they have to be released, and no program will take them. And I think this is an accident waiting to happen. We need to have some structured setting that will accept these offenders. An increase in anger management services, we offer those in three institutions now. We'd like to increase that. Substance abuse programs, increasing the salaries of people that work in the substance abuse programs. They're contracted with nonprofit agencies, and the salaries are so low that the turnover is pretty astronomical. In certain areas like Bethel, we sometimes will go a whole year without having a substance abuse counselor for more than 2 or 3 months, just because the salary is not enough to keep somebody there. We've got a request for increase in sex offender treatment money, change in funding source from program receipts to general funds for part of Spring Creek, and additional money to reduce vacancy factors at a couple of institutions that ended up with vacancy factors that are unworkable. We have a lot of vacancy factors that we think we can work with and we're going to live with, but there were a couple institutions where the vacancy factor we felt was just too high. I think I'm going to just skip over the unfunded increments. I don't expect to get those, and we'll just move along onto the capital request. I believe there's a committee that is working on a way to develop a formula for renovation and repair requests for those agencies that actually are maintaining buildings. And I think that by next year, if we have a formula that makes sense, that would be a better way than just ask for a lump sum in renovation and repair. In Fairbanks, we need to do a renovation of the control room and the booking area. The Palmer Minimum facility is literally falling apart. That facility needs to be replaced and expanded. To give you an example of how inexpensively we can build minimum security space, the Spring Creek facility, which was designed to hold 288 inmates for maximum security inmates, cost about $42 million. At Palmer, we can build 250 beds for $6.5 million. So it's very inexpensive space to build, and that is, we do need expansion there, and as I said, the existing facility is falling apart. We're constantly in trouble with DEC about the condition of the kitchen. Highland Mountain, the control room, visiting room, and perimeter need upgrading, and we're continuing to work on the roof repair at Wildwood. We're in the third phase of that. The capital budget as it currently exists gives us, out of the $6.5 million we asked for the Palmer minimum facility expansion and renovation, I think we got $1 million, which essentially we could do the design phase, or we could perhaps design a little part of it and build it, maybe one of the housing modules or something. But the the other $5.5 million was not funded. And as far as the proposed legislation, I just want to strongly support Representative Ulmer's DWI-DWLS legislation. There is going to be introduced from the governor's office legislation about limiting liability that is not that's still in the drafting stage. And the last one we have is a sunset provision to extend the parole board. Any questions?
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if you could expand on the direction that the governor and your office are looking at in limiting liability.
Well, it hasn't been nailed down 100% whether it's going to be a total immunity or whether it would be a gross negligence standard, and that's what's being discussed right now. There are some people who believe the current Title 47 has a statement of immunity in there. Whether it's an enforceable immunity is the question that we're wrestling with. So some people are saying if we set a gross negligence standard, we would actually be backing off from the total immunity that they believe is in the current statute. I know the Municipal League has been very interested in having a total immunity bill introduced.
Is this for officers or?
For officers and medical, I think medical staff. There may be two separate bills. Again, it's still in the concept paper stage. We'll have another meeting scheduled on that.
Because it seems, you know, this issue has been an area that I've been interested in, and I think that the state of Alaska does have a responsibility in the area of safety and to keep the state of Alaska responsible, maybe contrary to eliminating that liability. So I think that I have some concerns about it, but we'll view the legislation when.
Okay. Well, I guess I would agree with you. We don't want to have something that makes it appear that it's a bill that allows people to shirk responsibility. On the other hand, if we use a standard, let's say gross negligence, where if somebody is grossly negligent, they're going to be liable, as opposed to just doing their duties in good faith and still having something bad happen.
Yes, Representative Bowman.
Thank you. I have two questions. First of all, with regard to out-of-state contractual, just looking down the budget, I realize in the last few years we've been bringing more and more of our prisoners home, partially because we had to and partially because it was a good idea. But we obviously still have some folks outside. Could you just explain to us briefly who is outside and if they're also scheduled to come back to Alaska or what's happening?
No.